In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
If you're of a certain age, you probably remember Baghdad Bob. He was the Iraqi Minister of Information in the Second Gulf War who would be out there saying how great things are going and how the Iraqis are soundly defeating the evil Americans. And meanwhile, there are American tanks in the background of the shot rolling towards him. Baghdad Bob could probably get a job with the Biden administration talking about the economy, because no matter what Biden and his minions are saying, Bidenomics is not doing very well right now. But how do you know? It's one thing to assume that if the Democrats' lips are moving, they must be lying, but how do you really know? How do you assess the economy? What are the things you should be looking for to know whether things are in fact moving in the right direction or the wrong direction? And it's not just what to look for, but whom to trust when you find it. Is the data reliable? Is the source interpreting that data reliable? And even if they are reliable, what should you make of it? And why does any of it matter? Well, of course, part of it is your job may depend on whether or not the economy does well. And the economy does well when the right people are in charge and doing the right things. And right now, there are some troubling signs. GDP, that's gross domestic product, in the first quarter came in at half the rate of what is considered normal growth. And it was less than half the growth of the previous quarter, the last quarter of 2023. The jobs report for April was not very good. We know they lie about the good numbers, but when they come in so bad that they can't hide it, that's troubling. One of the more startling numbers from that job report was the measurement that includes discouraged workers and those holding part-time jobs because they can't make ends meet. That figure rose to 7.4%, the highest level since November 2021. So on today's show, we're talking about Bidenomics. We'll be taking a deeper look beyond the headlines, but also on today's show, we're going to help you learn to think like an economist. What are some of the trigger points you should be looking for? What are some of the more reliable measurements, both for a good economy and a bad economy? When an economy is doing well, what are some of the levers they can pull to keep it going well? And when the economy is bad, what are the levers they need to pull to turn things around? And all of that to help you to pick the right people, to put them in charge, to get the economy on the right track. I'd like to welcome Jonathan Williams back to the show. He is the Executive Vice President of Policy and the Chief Economist at American Legislative Exchange Council. That is ALEC. You can find out more at alec.org. Jonathan, it's great to talk to you again.
Well, it's always great to talk with you, my friend. Thanks for the invitation to join.
Yeah, absolutely. And so just remind people a little bit about what you do there at ALEC.
Well, so we are the nation's largest nonpartisan individual membership organization of state legislators who believe in free markets and limited government and federalism. Those are our three guiding principles. And we've been around now for 50 years as an organization to work in the state level. And as those issues then bubble up to the federal level as well, we have about 95 members of the current Congress who are alumnus members of ALEC, but we have about 2,000 members total across the United States working on developing real, you know, trusted policy solutions to some of the biggest policy challenges that we face. But at the end of the day, and as we've talked about many times, that guiding principle of federalism, you know, we believe that most good decisions don't happen in Washington, D.C., and they shouldn't be happening in Washington, D.C. They should be happening at the state level and at the local level. And of course, at the end of the day, empowering individuals.
Yes. Well, so we want to have you on to talk about the economy and also the Bidenomics, because it just doesn't seem to be working out as well as Biden would like. But to get things going, there have been a couple of headlines here, and this is one that probably a lot of people have missed, is that you out there may be thinking that you're spending way more now than you used to. I guess you're just too stupid, because according to Karine Jean-Pierre, prices are too low under the brilliant leadership of Joe Biden. I can't believe anybody would say that. But anyway, she is saying that housing prices, especially in the black communities, are too low. So she says they're going to fix that, apparently not seeing that housing prices have just notched new record highs again. So what are your thoughts on prices being too low right now?
Well, I had missed that comment, and I almost thought it might be a satirical Saturday Night Live type skit, because it can't be something literally coming out of the White House right now, given the huge problem that we've had with inflation over now several years, and the Biden administration with this massive run up in new federal spending. You know, first of all, they told us that, you know, we were mistaken, that inflation wasn't happening. They told us it was transitory, as we remember hearing, and it would just be a temporary blip. And now that we're several years in, I guess they've gone back to the start to say, you know, inflation isn't happening after all anymore, and prices are too low. It's hard for me to keep that story straight. It's clearly difficult for the Biden administration to keep a straight story on this.
Yeah, really. You know, one of the things that also came out this week, and maybe this is how they plan on fixing those low home prices, is that Biden just released a new climate change rule that will force home builders to raise the minimum energy standards for new home construction. And two of the nation's home builders associations say that doing so is going to add a minimum of $31,000 to the price of a new home. And, you know, they're doing this to save energy. Well, if you want to save energy, $31,000, if you're paying $200 a month on your utilities, $31,000 is enough to pay for about 13 years of monthly utility bills.
That's shocking, right? I mean, that's it's just, I saw those numbers myself, and it was staggering to see what the regulatory cost is of building and just home ownership. I mean, now you have local governments out there looking to insert themselves into these decisions from home builders and buyers, and getting in the way of the free market by saying, you know, you cannot have natural gas hookups, let's say, in new constructions in some cities across the United States, which is just shocking. And then you look overall, and, you know, what is going on when it comes to the housing market? It's, you know, certainly not that housing, you know, costs are too low. It's that they're too high. And there's, you know, what do you do about it is one of the biggest challenges in red and blue states alike, as we've traveled around the country. And, you know, one of the big things that you can do without it costing a dime from a federal budget perspective is reduce that regulatory cost. But another, you know, common sense economics 101 way of handling this issue is, you know, tackling the supply challenges, where you've had so many states and localities restrict the supply of even building new homes for whatever reason. A lot of times it's the green far left environmentalist movement that doesn't want any more development, or it's the NIMBYs, not in my backyard. Maybe we have your, our is that we don't want more people moving in. But regardless of the motivation, I mean, there's a serious shortage of affordable housing, and it's not a big government solution that's going to solve it. It's going to be a market-based solution. And so getting to the issues that you just talked about there, Mark, on the regulatory costs and burden is a major driver, and is something that needs to be solved.
Speaking of market-based solutions, unfortunately, so many of the solutions from the left are not that. Out here in Oregon, the governor wants to increase home building by 26,000 new homes per year, but at the same time, she's shutting down the logging industry. So I guess we're just building these out of mud, I guess. You know, we got a lot of that in Oregon during the winter. But yeah, it's just insane that so many of these policies just run directly contrary to reality. Real quick here, one of the other things that happened, I think the figure just came out earlier this week, that CNBC is reporting GDP slowed to 1.6% in the first quarter. And that was well below the 2.4% estimate. And, you know, normal GDP is typically seen as 3%. So can you address that real quick?
Well, that was a shockingly bad number for America, and in an election year for Joe Biden, it's got to be very worrying. And I don't know what kind of spin they're going to try to put on this one, but you know, that is a bad number. It's something that, as you dig into the details, it's actually worse. One of the economists that is a friend of ours that I follow closely, Brian Westbury, pointed out the other day is, you know, of that GDP growth, you know, the anemic 1.6 growth that you just mentioned, you look at how much of it is actually driven by federal government spending and transfer payments, and you're looking at somewhere in the vicinity of 50% of that total GDP growth number is driven by government intervention in spending. And so you almost have to, you know, ask yourself, are we even measuring the right thing to look at what is meaningful when it comes to economic growth?
Yeah. I have often thought that we really shouldn't be counting government spending anymore in GDP. I just think it convolutes that number. But, you know, for an economy that's supposed to be doing great, Bidenomics just doesn't seem to be doing so hot, which is, I guess, maybe why they don't want people to use the term Bidenomics anymore, since it directly ties the poor economy with the guy making it poor. Okay, we are up for a break here. Coming up, learn to be an economist, or at least how to think like one. How is that Bidenomics working out for you? We're looking at the economy today and doing that with Jonathan Williams, the American Legislative Exchange Council's Executive Vice President of Policy and their Chief Economist. You can find out more about ALEC, and you can also encourage your state representatives to join so they can be part of the solution. And you can do that by heading to ALEC.org. That's ALEC.org. And so, Jonathan, one of the big things that we always want to do here on iSpy is to help people increase their understanding and knowledge about the various issues, and that includes things like economics. So let's just pretend for a moment that you're teaching an economics class. And as an economist, what are some of the basic things that you look at to assess an economy? In other words, you know, what are you looking for? How do you know an economy is doing well and is likely to continue to do well?
Well, it's a great question. And as I've gone out and guest lectured at different universities over the years and worked with economic students, you know, for me, it comes down to really the base level, right? I mean, we can spend a lot of time talking about the big picture numbers that get all the attention on the national media and the GDP, for instance, as we were just talking about, or, you know, income growth or things like that. But I think when you look at fundamentally, how do you know whether policy is good or bad? How do you know whether an economy is healthy or not? You have to look at a little bit lower level and the more intricate interactions between, because what is an economy? It's made up of a bunch of individuals, right? And businesses, right, and people that voluntarily organize and come together and through things like in a free market, through price signals, make decisions about their lives. And that's, it's basically human action is economics. And this is, you know, how I learned it from a free market perspective, being a student of Hayek and Mises and the great free market economists. You know, in fact, one individual that the book that got me interested in economics was a book called Economics in One Lesson. Huh. And I would highly recommend it to anyone. It's an old book, and it was actually written by a journalist, Henry Hazlitt. And he was a journalist at the Wall Street Journal and other newspapers, but he took it from a common sense, basic perspective of incentives, of the role of that in individual decision making. Because at the end of the day, you know, macroeconomics is important, but macroeconomics is just an aggregated sense of what individuals and business do to make their lives better off and make their businesses better off. And so breaking decisions down to that base level is really, I think, one of the most important things you can do. And so when we analyze what works across the states in our rich states, poor states book, for instance, you know, we do look at GDP growth, we look at income growth, all the other major factors. But as you know, Mark, we've talked about this dozens of times over the years, one of the most impactful statistics that we measure every year in rich states, poor states, is the interactions of individuals as they vote with their feet across state lines, and looking at, you know, why is it that the low tax states that have a free market environment always tend to be the states that are gaining population, and the states that have a big government format that has high regulation costs, high taxation costs, and big spending policies always losing individuals and businesses. And this is the revealed preferences, as we like to say in economics, that really matter. And so, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, sometimes you get a big government policy that is, you know, purported by, you know, some do-gooding, you know, well-meaning individual that's out there that says, you know, this is going to be good for the economy. But you have to bring it back to, once again, the 101 base level to say, if this is not going to be good for individuals and for businesses in their own lives, how can you aggregate that and say it's going to be good for the broad economy? And, right, you know, this is where the big government arguments oftentimes break down.
Right. So, speaking of government, what are some of the economic levers that a government can pull to create a good economy, or to make a good one even better, or at least to ensure things that things aren't going to start getting worse?
Well, you know, one of the best things from a free market perspective is obviously when government gets out of the way and doesn't interfere in the individual transactions of individuals and businesses, right? I mean, this is one of the most key, it's overlooked lesson. It's not something that is something that DC likes to do very often in the federal government. I mean, so many times our elected officials have the, I like to call it the do something disease. They're elected, so we must therefore go and act new laws and put more government regulations on individuals and businesses instead of just saying, all right, what are the things that government can do to obviously support a rule of law, support infrastructure and basic things that governments need to do, the so-called public goods that are things that government should be focusing on, protecting life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. But everything else, trying to keep government as limited as possible. And so, you know, obviously taxation is one that comes down to its very base level. When government grows, it by necessity takes more out of individuals' pocketbooks and the pocketbooks of businesses. And at the end of the day, businesses don't pay taxes, people do. So it all comes from individuals. And so making those arguments around the size and scope of government are huge when it comes to how a government is going to impact the choices of individuals in the marketplace. And the bigger the government gets, the worse the effects get. And it's not a linear equation. This is why we see things like the Laffer curve in economics, mm-hmm. where when government gets too big and taxes get too high, you reach a tipping point that you actually get less economic activity and then run into this vicious cycle of less revenue because of the out-migration or because of less businesses actually taking part in the private sector economy. And so, you know, this is a counterintuitive way for many people to see economics, but it's the real-world way that economics works.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I have kind of a personal real-world example of the impact of taxation that has always stuck with me. Back when I was a poor college student studying English rather than economics, I went into the store one time and only had $1 on me, and I was going to buy some ramen noodles, and they were like five for a buck, except the tax meant I couldn't get all five. I could only get four because I had to pay for the tax on top of things. And I think it was Reagan who had said something along the lines of, if you want less of something, then tax it. And there was my personal experience with that. And I remember thinking at the time, it's not just me getting one fewer of an item, but from the company's standpoint, they lost 20% of my sale because I would have bought five, but thanks to that tax, I could only afford four of them. Okay, coming back, we're going to continue our lessons on economics. We're going to look at things from a bad economy standpoint. Stay with us. More with Jonathan Williams of ALEC. That's ALEC.org. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today about the economy and Bidenomics and how well that is doing or not. And we're doing that with Jonathan Williams from ALEC. That's the American Legislative Exchange Council, and he is their executive vice president and also their chief economist. You can find out more about them by heading to alec.org, and we'll link that up on today's show page, which is 1418 on iSpyRadio.com. And so, Jonathan, we've been talking about how you as an economist, if you were to teach people what to look for as for signs for a good economy, let's look at some of the signs now from a bad economy. What are some of the basic things that you look at to know that an economy is doing poorly and is likely going to get worse, despite what propagandists in the government may be saying?
Well, yeah, and this is, let me go to the big macro numbers first, and then we can go kind of back into the micro discussion of what it means and what governments do when things are bad. But, you know, when you look at what we've just been talking about, when you have anemic economic growth, and especially when you can parse out, you know, what is the actual private sector GDP type contribution to the overall economy instead of, you know, looking at the government interaction, which is obviously just reinteracting and redistributing wealth from the private sector to public sector, and then making the GDP numbers look even better than they are. And of course, that number was anemic. So it's very concerning when you see things like that. But, you know, you also get into this death spiral for economies when, you know, the big government policies, you know, have, you know, continue to spend and tax. And then you run into a situation where you have major inflation problems like we have. And you have the combo that we're currently facing with that low GDP number with inflation that's stubbornly high. Mm-hmm. And that's, of course, what economists call stagflation, lack of economic growth with too much money chasing around too few goods is the definition of inflation. So you have, this is the symptom of a big government approach that we've seen during the Biden administration of trillions of dollars of new spending. I mean, this is a good case study and a point in time to stop and say to the Keynesian economists out there, those that believe that more spending is always the solution to every problem with the economy, yeah, is, you know, we've had this natural experiment now for several years with trillions more added to federal deficit spend and to grow the federal government.
Yes,
and
shockingly
where is the
so.
Economic growth to go with it? 1.6% GDP growth. I mean, if this is the Keynesian dream, you know, why aren't we seeing massive economic growth like we would see under a Keynesian model? But I mean, this is the bad kind of the cycle of tax and spend, and then run into this phenomenon of low growth and high inflation. And that's the sign of a very unhealthy economy right now. And, you know, that's the macro numbers. You then look at the individuals, and you look at, let's say, one of the best surveys I know that's out there is the NFIB survey of small business optimism,
yes,
which is at a low mark right now. So not surprising, given that, you know, there's massive new proposals during an election year around capital gains taxes going sky high under the Biden administration, a global minimum tax on U.S.-based businesses being proposed, perhaps by Janet Yellen and others, among other tax increases on the horizon that really do, between that and the regulatory costs that we've been talking about, put a crimp on small businesses and those individual investors for their own incentives to say, we're not bullish about the future right now, given all of these dynamics from a policy perspective. And that's, of course, those individual decisions add up into something very more concerning long term. And that is, if businesses are not investing, what is going to power the economic growth going forward, other than more government intervention, getting to this vicious cycle continuing?
Yeah, there was a great article about that. I think it was titled "Why Small Businesses Hate Bidenomics," and it was in the Daily Signal. And I think, I'm pretty sure it was Stephen Moore that had written that. So yeah, he walks through that survey and how awful things are right now. And as far as you know, we kind of do the same thing we did in that last segment. So for an economy that is doing poorly, what are some of the basic levels or levers that can be pulled to improve that economy?
Well, and so, you know, an economy is going poorly. You think of the case studies, let's say, in a state like New York or California that always rank at the bottom of rich states, poor states, because of just decades long, or Oregon for that sense. I mean, you've lived it, Mark, decades long of this tax and spend mentality. You know, what you see go wrong then is these governments try to correct the action, but not the free market way. And they come in with the cronyism approach, which is, yeah, things are bad. Tax rates are high. Regulatory costs are high. We're losing businesses. And so they have to try to compete some way. And they can't bring themselves to compete through a free market context, just doing the right thing and simple thing by lowering tax rates and lowering government intervention in the marketplace. They double down on it to say, all right, we're going to keep the high taxes. But then based on who has the best lobbyist or who has the political favorites in state capital, we're going to reduce them or give them handouts on particular industries or particular businesses that sort of the leaders in that state like. And that is the worst way to choose winners and losers, right? I mean, the marketplace in a free market is going to have winners and losers, but that's done on meritocracy, right? To say those that are making the best goods and services and products are going to do well, and those that can't stay up with the trends are going to fall behind and have to reinvent themselves into another type of a business, for instance. But in the government sense, there's no failing. The government just comes in and props individuals up. And unfortunately, instead of done by merit, it's done by political favoritism and political correctness. And that's exactly the wrong way to go about doing things.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you had mentioned before we got going here that Jerome Powell is not looking at lowering the interest rates this year. And I hadn't heard that one yet, but if they're not looking to adjust those rates, is that a sign that things are going well or not so well?
Well, and it's a sign that things are pretty dangerous right now, because
right,
there's this dual problem. The Federal Reserve has this dual mandate, and it's very difficult right now for any head of the Federal Reserve to try to keep price levels at the old 2% target, which I think right now there's some real hedging going on. Larry Fink, the head of BlackRock, the other day, you know, said, well, if Fed can get the inflation rates down to 3%, they had to just call it a day and call it good. And, you know, that's, you know, throwing in the towel by basically saying we can't control inflation. But if you raise rates or, you know, don't cut rates at some point, you know, the cost of capital for small businesses is something that's certainly, you know, weighing them down in terms of borrowing and investing and making new hires. There is this difficult dance that the Federal Reserve is trying to do to bring it in for the so-called soft landing. And I'm, you know, Mark, frankly, not sure that they're going to be able to do it.
No, I don't think so either. It's too much government control, unfortunately, and their hands on the wrong levers. Okay, let's go and take a break there. Come back. We'll continue with Jonathan Williams. He is with American Legislative Exchange Council. And again, their website is alec.org. And welcome back. We're talking about the state of the economy today. We're doing that with Jonathan Williams. He is with ALEC. That's American Legislative Exchange Council. And you can visit them at alec.org. And he is their chief economist and also their executive vice president of policy. And so, Jonathan, we were talking about that article from Stephen Moore. And one of the things that he had mentioned there in terms of the lack of confidence by small businesses, if people are wondering why Bidenomics doesn't work for small businesses, here's a fun fact from that article. Neither Biden nor nearly any of his top officials have ever started or even worked for small or medium-sized businesses. It's all been big business. And when you don't have that hands-on approach, that hands-on background, of course you're going to pull the wrong levers.
Well, that's right. And you know, and even big business might be, you know, somewhat positive compared to those that just have government experience, right? That have no experience with anything in the private sector, have never made a balanced budget since the federal government gave up on that years ago, since the Newt Gingrich days of balancing the budget. And, you know, take a command and control approach over the economy and people's lives. I mean, so many in D.C. have always had that government perch where they just look at these government GDP statistics getting spit out and not understanding the reality of what goes into that and what's the driver, as we've been talking about, what real economics looks like.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned budget deficits there. Did you see that in the first 3 months of Argentina's new president there, Milei, they have their first budget surplus since, I think, 2008? And he managed to do that in just 3 months, something that we haven't done since the Newt Gingrich days.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, really only three times in recent history have we balanced a budget, and it was all during Speaker Gingrich. But it does show that, you know, if Argentina can turn it around, I mean, this pretty positive message there to say, you know, as bad as we have it right now with Bidenomics and the big government agenda in so many places across the United States, we are light years ahead of places like Argentina that have been in the doldrums for decades because of their big government policies and socialism, the massive inflation that they faced for so many years. And if they can elect somebody like Milei and say, hey, and within a number of months, we're going to have these free market reforms that are going to literally turn around that economy in short order, that's, to me, Mark, a pretty optimistic note to say, you know, there's hope for America, and it's not going to take nearly as long as it did to turn around Argentina if we have the right leaders in place to change the kind of policies that have been dragging us down for the last several years.
Yep. So we've been talking about how can the average person assess the economy. And, you know, one of the things that we consistently hear out in the news is unemployment numbers. Unfortunately, the Bureau of Labor and Statistics, BLS, although I think it ought to be more aptly named the Bureau of Lies and Statistics, because when it comes to unemployment numbers, they will often tout these great job numbers, but then they subtract it and readjust it about 2 or 3 months later when nobody's paying attention. I mean, I think if I remember right, there are about 3.5 million jobs that they had claimed since Biden took office that never actually existed. They've erased that many over the last 3.5 years. So in terms of measurements out there, what are some of the more reliable ones to assess the well-being of an economy, assuming those measurements are not being gamed by bureaucrats for political reasons to keep their guy in office?
Well, that's a big assumption, right? Whether it's the revision of GDP numbers that we've seen almost always revised downward recent times, whether it's revision of those BLS employment numbers or others. I mean, this is a track record that's been almost every month, as you pointed out, in recent times. The corrections, of course, just like any newspaper correction, doesn't ever get the kind of attention as the headline does.
Nope.
And so this is a real problem that I think puts a crisis of confidence of the American people when you look at these government provided statistics. And so I almost think is what is perhaps more accurate is looking at the NFIB type small business confidence numbers to say, here are the actual survey results from the job creators, those that are creating almost all of the net new jobs across the United States, are not big business over the last decade or two. It's been small business, mom and pop, and smaller manufacturers and things like that. And when you see such a difference of from what we see in the official government statistics versus what we're seeing from those on the ground making those hiring decisions, trying to grapple with these massive costs of investing and borrowing and hiring individuals with the regulatory and tax and all these other uncertainties, that's when you really have to start asking the questions.
Right.
And when you see that kind of a gap, I think my inclination is to go with the actual folks that are on the ground and those small business owners.
Yeah, because those are the people that are asking themselves, do I really want to take a chance on this? And I think the fact
in many cases, it's personal bankruptcy for them if it doesn't go right.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, they're putting their savings on the line, their futures on the line. They have it all out there. And if they don't feel confident enough to make that additional investment or make the additional hire, that should send warning signs across every policymaker's desk.
So what about other measurements like the stock market and how well or not that it is doing? That used to be, I think, a pretty reliable assessment when it comes to the economy. But nowadays, people buy stocks based purely on hype and headlines rather than a company's underlying fundamentals. So I'm not so sure about that anymore as an assessment tool for the economy.
Well, it's a little bit more complicated now, right? And there's a lot of speculation there, obviously.
Tons of it. Yeah.
There are certain areas of the economy that are doing very well. I mean, if you've been in AI stocks, you've done very well this year. If you've been in the market, take away several of those large tech companies, for instance, you have not done nearly as well. It's a leading indicator, right? I mean, it's something that is based on the expectations of future profits and interest rates and other key things that go into this. But one thing that was just brought up the other day is now this beginning, this reality and Powell's announcement from earlier about interest rates not going down probably through the rest of this year, keep a very close eye on business profitability, because that's the other thing that can, really try to keep these equity levels at, the higher, I know we've fallen a little bit here in the last month, especially, but if business profitability doesn't come through, and then you combine that with now more of a market realization that interest rates are not going down, I think that's when you really run into a scenario where we could see a pretty major drop in the stock market.
Yeah. Yeah, that would definitely be worrisome. Okay. It is time for a break. Come back. We're going to be talking about Oregon. They actually moved up a notch this year in rich states, poor states. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show, and we're talking with Jonathan Williams, the Executive Vice President of Policy and the Chief Economist for ALEC. And ALEC just released its 17th edition of Rich States, Poor States back on April 15th. That is their annual ranking of all 50 states' economic competitiveness and outlook. And for Oregon, Rich States, Poor States hold some good news, bad news. The good news is, in terms of economic performance over the last 10 years, Oregon ranks 13th, so that's pretty good. We're not quite in the top 10, but pretty close. But Oregon is ranked 42nd in economic outlook. That's the forecast based on 15 policy variables. And there's some of those where we rank 49th, and that's not good. But we did move up one spot, though, from last year. Was that due to us moving up because of what we did, or was it a case of people above us moving down?
Well, it can be a little bit of both. There's a lot of competition at the top of the ranking, and you can fall behind by standing still, as we like to say. And there's a lot of competition at the bottom of the ranking where a lot of states are doing bad things in that bottom 10. And I will say it's the same group of 10 states in the bottom 10 this year as it was last year, with a little bit of movement in between. And so sometimes with these relative rankings is you absolutely can move one way or the other, especially if it's a one or two slot move like Oregon's slight improvement, due to nothing positive coming out of the Capitol and legislators' actions, but just due to other actions of other states doing things worse. And so the one thing I would point to when you look at Oregon specifics in rich states, poor states, based on these 15 equalated factors that we've used now for the last 17 years, and one is that is the debt service as a share of tax revenue that improved several slots in Oregon this last year. That may have been one of the reasons there. And that variable is a little bit of different one to really unpack. But that can mean several different things. It can mean that the debt level has gone down, which is probably unlikely in Oregon's case.
Yeah,
and it also
so.
Can mean the difference around the timing of the transactions and the interest on that debt and the duration of the debt and things like that. So that comes from the Census Bureau. And maybe on a future show, we can investigate a little bit more on what happened there. But it's not a straightforward answer, unfortunately.
Well, one of the cooler things that people can do on the Rich States, Poor States website, and that's just simply richstatespoorstates.org, you can go to Oregon's or any state's Economic Outlook rankings, and then you use the red tab there to adjust the policies. And you can see the various impacts when you tweak some of the potential economic levers, you know, that we were talking about earlier. And so looking at Oregon, I did do a side-by-side comparison there from last year to this year. As you mentioned, it was the debt service. Our ranking dropped from 25th down to 30. It dropped from 31 down to 25. So a good improvement there. But then we also had property tax burden that went. Our ranking was 35. We dropped to 33, and then also remaining tax burden. We were at 42, but we dropped down to 49 on that one. That actually went up quite a bit from 21.85 to 28.57. And then we did have a slight decrease in recently legislated tax changes, and that was it's a minus 15 cents per $1,000 of tax burden. So, like I said, these numbers are pretty cool to be able to adjust those. Of those four, property tax burden, remaining tax burden, legislative tax burden, and also the share of tax revenue, which one of those is really the most impact? Is it that debt service?
Well, it's probably the thing that moved its ranking this year, if anything did, just given all the movement in states around Oregon as well. What actually matters for economic growth, though, are things to be much more worried about than some of those variables. I mean, I think of the 15 that we measure, you know, the overall personal income tax rate, the overall business income tax rate, how progressive a system is, and how much it takes more from those who are earning and successful in small businesses, for instance. I mean, those are three of the most important variables. And in the case of Oregon, Oregon comes in 49, 49, 49 in those top three variables right there. And so, yeah, there is some movement, and some of it's positive, as you talked about. But I mean, still looking at the fundamentals, this is the kind of thing that weighs, you know, Oregon down, is those top three variables and almost dead last in each of them.
So playing with all of those different variables, as people go onto that website and kind of want to tweak things, is there one in particular that you find for any state that really makes the biggest impact if you were to make a major change in that variable?
Well, there's a couple. I think that, you know, having a state level death tax is just economic incompetence, that so many states have gotten rid of a state level death tax. It is one more thing that drives individuals out towards the end of life as they're some of their most successful income earning years in many cases, and going to almost all states have gotten rid of the state level death tax. So that's something that, you know, probably costs zero. It's probably a Laffer curve negative change, right, where you're actually going to, you know, gain more revenue by eliminating the death tax because you keep more taxpayers in your state. Now, that's an easy one. But, you know, looking at those income tax rates, as I mentioned, You know, you look at the 9 states without personal income taxes altogether that we do every year in rich states, poor states, or the states that have gone to flat taxes. And that is a key driver of why some states are more successful than others. I mean, back to this economics 101 discussion is, why is it that small business survey is so bad from NFIB? And why is it worse in states like California and New York? Is because NFIB small businesses, the vast majority of them, pay their taxes on the individual side of the tax code. And so that driver right there is a key element for why some states are rich states and when some states are poor states, because it's a direct disincentive for businesses to do business in your state. So lots that really matter, but those are the two of the most important.
Well, you had mentioned people moving out due to the death tax, and that's why a lot of businesses or former business people move out of the state as they get closer to end of life there. We have a friend that is looking at moving out of the state, and they did the calculations, and by moving from Oregon to Arizona, they're going to save $1,000 a month just relocating.
That's
where
surprising.
They're. Yeah, so it's pretty shocking.
And, and Arizona still has an income tax. I mean, even some of the states that don't tax income altogether, I mean, some people save a whole lot more. I mean, it's such an incentive for people to go across state lines, and that's why we're seeing more and more of it, especially as individuals can work from wherever they'd like in a mobile workforce after COVID.
Yep, that's the thing, is they're going to be able to keep their job, and they're just changing states and saving $12,000 a year. I mean, that's pretty shocking. So I can't help but notice on that website to adjust policies, stop electing the same people who are keeping Oregon's rankings in the 40s is not one of the options available to tweak. Am I missing that? That doesn't seem to be available.
Yeah, that's right. It's the stop digging the hole deeper start to get out of the problem, right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay, we will wrap things up with Jonathan Williams coming up after this. And welcome back into our final segment now with Jonathan Williams. He is the Executive Vice President of Policy and the Chief Economist for American Legislative Exchange Council. You can visit them at alec.org, and we'll link that up on today's show page. Again, that's 1418. And so, Jonathan, we always like to end with kind of a look ahead at the future and what's coming, and also wrap up some things that we didn't quite get to but wanted to. So we'll try to cover both of those topics in the time remaining here. But let's start with looking down the road here. Let's say that President Trump gets reelected. And what are some of the first steps, some of those first levers that you would want him to take to turn the economy around and get it chugging again?
Well, it's going to be a busy first 100 days, really? I think, in a potential Trump administration, right? There's a lot to unwind of the bad policies that have happened over the last several years in the Biden administration. You know, a few that really stick out. I mean, one of the biggest ones that, you know, is adding to this massive economic uncertainty that's keeping capital on the sidelines, it's discouraging small businesses with those bad confidence numbers, is the coming expiration of the Trump tax cuts, the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which by the end of 2025, if Congress and if the federal government doesn't come together and actually affirmatively extend those provisions, they go away. And that's 23 provisions of individual taxpayers, everything from child care tax credit, from the reduced rates on small businesses and individuals on income tax rates, and other factors such as the state and local tax deduction limitation that was a huge reform during the Trump years. All those things go away. And so I think job number one to reassess the American economy and to get America moving again is to remove that just horrible lack of confidence that these tax cuts will be extended. And so we right now, Alec is in the midst of having state legislators sign on a letter to Congress into the White House saying this would be economic calamity if we allow these tax cuts to expire in this time of stagflation that we currently suffer. I mean, that's a big one. A couple of other things on the regulatory front is resuming the 2-for-1 rule that was so successful, I thought, during the Trump years, didn't get nearly enough media attention, but was to repeal 2 regulations for every 1 new regulation. And in fact, many times during the Trump administration, it was closer to probably 5 or 10 to 1 regulations repealed to remove those regulatory roadblocks, like the cost of housing that we talked about a little bit earlier. And so those are just 2, but there's so many other areas that this new administration should tackle if we want to get inflation under control and economic growth moving again.
Yeah, I think those first 100 days, you said it's going to be pretty busy. They could probably save a lot of time if they just pass an executive order. Whatever Biden did, we're undoing. So just leave it at that. One of the other things, too, that I'd like to get your thoughts on is Mike Johnson. He's kind of been battled right now. MTG, that's Marjorie Taylor Greene, has said that she is going to introduce a resolution next week to vacate. You know, when he came into office, both of us, you and I, had really high hopes for him. I know that he's an ALEC alum there. I know that you know him pretty well. But unfortunately, things have kind of not turned out as well as we would have liked. And, you know, politics, I think, is a story, unfortunately, that depends on people not remembering that last chapter. And MTG, I think, is a prime example of that. She wants to vacate Johnson because he has failed on his promises and instead has spent tens of billions of dollars on Ukraine, another $30 billion on other foreign aid in that last package, but nothing here at home on the border and nothing at all to rein in big government spending. But she's forgetting that last chapter because when McCarthy was there, she was his biggest supporter, despite the fact that McCarthy failed on his promises, spent tens of billions of dollars on Ukraine, another and foreign aid as well, but nothing here at home on the border and nothing at all to rein in government spending. So it's like she's forgotten all about that.
Well, you know, and I'm still optimistic about Speaker Johnson. I think he's a good man. He's a conservative man at the heart of it. And I think he's a good leader. He's just in a very difficult position right now with basically a one vote margin. And then anything that you even were to get through the kind of the raucous caucus that they have right now in the House, you have to deal with Chuck Schumer on the other end of the building. And then, of course, you have to deal with the veto in a Joe Biden administration. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's the bipartisan spending binge has been going on for decades, as we know. So, I mean, I don't really lay that as a fault of Speaker Johnson's. And I'm still an optimist at heart, Mark. And I truly believe he's in it for the right reasons. And Speaker Johnson needs some more time to actually see some results. And, you know, the incentives right now, as you and I have talked, I mean, I think it's somewhat unfortunate that you have a scenario where one member of 435 could call for a motion to vacate the chair and remove a speaker. I mean, that would ensure chaos over the next 6 months leading up to the election probably guarantee a progressive Democrat sitting in that speaker's chair going forward.
Yeah, and wouldn't that be horrible? Trump gets reelected and then the Democrats take over the House and the first thing they do is impeach him again before he's even done anything. I could certainly see that happening. Real quick, we only got about a minute here with you. DEI, the Supreme Court recently ruled in a way that's going to effectively remove that, and it was a 9-0 ruling, and which was great because even those liberals that are on there, it really shows that at its heart, America agrees on the fundamentals that discrimination is wrong, no matter who you're discriminating against. But talk to us a little bit real quick about the impact of DEI going away in the workforce.
Well, I mean, I think this is a really big move. You combine this decision with the Harvard decision around saying race-based admissions should not be allowed. And it does move, I think, America in a much more favorable space to say we should not judge people on the color of their skin or by any other attribute and discriminate against them in any single way, but we should judge them in the content of their character. I mean, that's obviously, I stand with Martin Luther King in that. I know you do too.
Yes, absolutely.
And I do think that these rulings really will make business leaders more confident in rewarding meritocracy, right? And talking about those people that are doing the things based on the merits, regardless of their backgrounds, let's just hire the most competent people to get the job done.
Yeah.
Isn't that common sense American values right there?
It is common sense, and it also makes businesses better because you know the people that are working there are the most competent, skilled ones. Jonathan, unfortunately, we are up against the clock. I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Always great to join you, my friend.
Real quick on that DEI ruling, effectively, the Supreme Court removed the high legal bar for plaintiffs to show significant harm. What they said was discrimination itself is harm, and that includes white people being forced to undergo training telling them to be less white. Discrimination is discrimination. And that's what America should be all about, all of us getting along despite our different backgrounds. America or any nation is always strongest when they're pulling together. Let's make that happen by getting rid of the incompetent people who are holding us back, who are dividing us, and who don't know what they're doing when it comes to things like the economy or anything else. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense.
the I Spy Radio Show.